Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Antioch University, New England, helping students change the world with graduate degrees in environmental studies, psychology, education, and management. antioch.edu/new-england.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Whether you call them education savings accounts or scholarships or school vouchers, a bill on this topic returns to the House Education Committee tomorrow. It's called SB 193, and it would give participating families roughly $3,300 in a special account to spend on their child's education outside the public schools. The funds would come from that child's adequacy grant. That's the money local districts receive from the state per student. So, depending on your view, this bill represents a new opportunity for all kids to choose the education they need or another whack at local public school funding. Today in The Exchange, round two for education savings accounts. Let's get your questions in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. With me in studio is Dan Vallone, Director of Engagement for Reaching Higher NH, a nonprofit that advocates for public schools. And Dan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to see you.
Also with us, Kate Baker, head of the Children's Scholarship Fund. That's a nonprofit that provides scholarships for low and moderate income families to attend private school or homeschool. And Kate, welcome back to you too. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Jason Moon, education and Seacoast reporter for NHPR. You can find Jason's reporting on this topic and other stories at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Jason, thank you for helping us out.
Good morning. My pleasure.
And Jason, this bill has been called the most expansive, wide-ranging school choice program in the country. That's a pretty big description. What do you think?
Yeah, that could be a fair way to describe the bill. The reason it's thought of as being very expansive is because of the eligibility requirements for the program. So these education savings accounts have been instituted in other states, but generally they are targeted at subsections of student populations, so students with disabilities or students who go to public schools that have a track record of failure. This program, the eligibility requirements are very broad. It essentially leaves it up to the individual parents. So in essence, any student who's gone to public school, I think, for two semesters, at least two semesters, is eligible for this. So it's expansive in that any public school student in New Hampshire could take advantage of it. And that's unusual in terms of the national landscape of these programs.
So nationally, I think I read about a dozen, maybe more, states have this, Jason, and in all cases they keep it to a limited group of people, students with disabilities, students from very low-income households, and so forth.
That's the general idea. That's how these programs first got started. There are two states who have endeavored to do something really similar to this bill, Arizona and Nevada is the other. Neither of those has actually gone into effect, though. One is held up in the courts. The other one is going to be phased in, but it's being challenged by a voter referendum coming up soon. So if this were to pass and it goes into effect 18-19 school year, we would be the first really to tread into this new world, which is either really exciting or pretty terrifying, depending on your perspective here.
Well, and Dan and Kate will help us out with that for sure. So that's the national picture, Jason, and that's really interesting to fit this bill into the national context. This particular idea for education savings accounts, Jason, has been around the block before in New Hampshire. So just what's the history there?
This bill came up last session, sponsored by State Senator John Reagan, I believe, and it was certainly one of the most debated education bills, if not the most, in the entire session. And it, because of all the reasons we just mentioned, it brought a lot of attention from both school choice advocates as this huge opportunity, or public school supporters as a huge threat. And eventually, it got tabled. I think partly over concerns about its whether it would withstand a legal challenge. There are a lot of questions about. I think if this bill were to be passed, I think it would be immediately challenged in the courts. So there was some concern from the bill sponsors about that, whether it could stand up to that scrutiny. And I think there was also a sense that this is a big piece of legislation. They kind of wanted to put it through its paces and do a little more their due diligence to get the bill ready. So now they're ready. It's coming back.
Again, the number for you to join us with your questions and comments about what's in place now in New Hampshire and some of the changes that Jason described, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Kate, as I said earlier, you're head of the Children's Scholarship Fund and a big fan of this SB 193 that we're talking about. But just before we talk about how this bill would change what we have already in New Hampshire, just describe how this Children's Scholarship Fund works, what we have now.
Yeah, so low and moderate income families contact us for scholarships. They may or may not have chosen a school where they're where they want to send their child. They're generally contacting us for, a few different reasons. One, academics. Either their child is significantly behind in school, or sometimes their child is significantly ahead, and so they want a different education environment for them. The next reason really is discrimination and bullying. We're hearing a lot of that right now, where a child might be in a school where they're experiencing those challenges and need to be in a different educational environment. The other reason is families with special needs, children with IEPs who want a different type of school environment. Our scholarships are means tested. They're for families 300% of the poverty line or below, and we're only determining them based on financial need.
And where does the money come from for these scholarships, Kate? Just
businesses can make a contribution, and individuals, in fact. Businesses and individuals contribute. We also, for those business contributors, offer a tax credit similar to Community Development Finance Authority, CDFA tax credits that are available for projects. This tax credit is available so businesses can be incentivized to contribute to education.
And there was some criticism when this first came out, right, Kate, that this
actually really funny, Laura.
Taking tax dollars because business got a tax credit.
Yeah,
go ahead.
The same arguments that we're hearing about the education tax credit. They're the same arguments that we're hearing about the ESA, like that this will become giant and, you know, hundreds of thousands of children will take these scholarships and it will decimate public schools. And, you know, there's 173,000 children in public schools and there's 260 children in our program. So while, you know, it's interesting to watch the argument back and forth, you know, from a boots on the ground perspective, a person helping families, you know, I'm hearing from families that are, you know, in a jam or the child needs something different. And so the question will be to all of us, kind of how many families are in that space. And I don't know if there's really a way to figure that out.
And we'll dig into that for sure. And Dan Vallone has some numbers. But one last question for you, Kate, on this. So you described what you're working on now. How would this change under this revised approach? Because as Jason told us, this is a pretty significant expansion of school choice here in New Hampshire.
Right. So currently, when we raise funds, right, from the donations from individuals and businesses, and when we expend all of those funds, we can't help any more children, right? And so this education savings account would create an environment where if a family came, say, in the middle of the school year and was in a bullying situation and wanted to switch to a different school, you know, in essence now, they could apply for an education savings account and receive it right away and make those moves. And it wouldn't necessarily be contingent on whether or not I have extra funds raised in the pool. You know, we've been expending all the dollars that we raise every year. And so
once your fund is tapped out, it's tapped out.
Correct. This would create a mechanism where the family would be able to do that at any time, as long as they meet the income, you know, meet the requirements, of course, of the law.
And one last issue, and then I do want to bring you in, Dan. the funds, instead of coming from donations from individuals and businesses, Kate, would come from that child's adequacy grant. So we are talking public dollars, is that correct?
It would be public dollars from the general fund, in fact. So the way that the adequacy dollars work is that's money transferred into the education trust fund. So it wouldn't be that money because that money goes for children that are counted in public school seats. This money would have to be a budget line item in the general fund that is extra, more money for education. But yes, definitely state dollars okay. in a budget for sure.
So Dan Vallone, let's get you in on this. You have been strongly opposed. How come?
So let's just step back a quick second to give some background for some of the reports that Reaching Higher produced in the last 2 weeks. So in my last job, I was chief of staff for the Office of Innovation and Improvement at the U.S. Department of Education. In that role, I helped manage 25 different competitive grant programs that invested about $1 billion every year in innovation to support what works in education across the country. We had grantees that were states, schools, nonprofits across every state in the country. And that experience taught me that it's very important to have a set of criteria that you use to evaluate policy. Because right now, everything gets politicized, and whatever issue comes up, you have people take sides based on politics. But when you have criteria, you can step back and say, does this make sense? So the three criteria that I use that I think make sense to look at SB 193, the first is, what does the research say? Let's learn from what other states have done, see what the results have been. The second is, how would it impact the unique local context? What works in one state isn't going to work in another state. What works in one city in one state isn't going to work in another town in the same state. And finally, what is the risk that there could be negative impacts on students? Because we should always avoid policies that have been proven to have negative outcomes. So it's really with respect to that second criteria that Reaching Higher has dug in the last few weeks to look at what would SB 193, what are the potential implications for New Hampshire's unique context? We are a rural state with many small schools, and we have an education funding system that relies overwhelmingly on local property taxes. So in the first analysis, we said, well, in both analyses, we looked at what would it look like if between 1% and 5% of New Hampshire students chose a voucher. And we can talk about why those numbers are conservative and reasonable and where we got them. And we said, what would the financial impact be for the loss in state aid? Because as we talked about, the state gives out adequacy aid on a per-pupil basis. So for every student that chooses the voucher, that community is going to lose about $3,600 in state aid. That's a conservative figure because there is additional aid that might go with that student. And in our first report, we said, what would it look like in terms of teacher salaries? We use the average teacher salary for every school district. It's public data. And that way, you can compare across the state. And so what that looks like is in Manchester, if 3% of the students choose a voucher, Manchester will lose about $1.5 million in state aid.
And I'm going to jump in, Dan, and I know you're sort of trying to create a big picture here, but just to jump in because it is confusing for people. So I'm going to give you a for instance. I have two kids. Let's say one of them, they both go to Concord Public Schools. Let's say one of them, you know, is having a real problem and I need to send him to a local private school. So if this bill were law, what would happen? If I, you know, I would be able to access those funds, $3,300, $3,600.
Right. So the bill would have a parent sign up for a contract with a scholarship organization. The dollars are then transferred from the state to the scholarship organizations. Parents can then access them. It's unclear. One of the considerations we're also going to talk about a little bit later on, I'm sure, is that a lot of lack in terms of definitions. So we assume that Kate Baker's organization is going to be a scholarship organization, but there's nothing prohibiting new scholarship organizations from standing up. And that's been a real problem. In Arizona, we had a state senator create a scholarship organization, and he's basically funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars in state aid to himself via these scholarship organizations because there's very little oversight. There's no requirement for there to be public representation on the Board of Trustees, for example.
Well, we'll talk about that. But just walk me through the finances. So my kid's having a problem in the Concord Public Schools. I say, sure, we can go to the private school. Not that, you know, I'm saying this is happening, but then what happens? I get $3,300 to $3,600 new dollars to send him wherever. And the Concord Public Schools loses that same $3,300 to $3,600.
That's correct, right.
So that's how you were coming at these bigger numbers, Dan.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes,
that so Manchester would lose X.
Right. So every student in a school district that signs up for a voucher, that district, that community will lose the corresponding state aid, which is about $3,600 for every student. So again, if Manchester, that's about, if 3% of students choose a voucher, that's $1.5 million or the equivalent of 24 teacher salaries. Across the state, 3% would equate to about $20 million in lost state aid, which is the equivalent of 333 teacher salaries. In our second report, we looked at what does that look like in terms of local tax impact. And here, what we discovered was that property-poor communities, such as Berlin or Franklin or Pittsfield, would need to raise local taxes six times as much as wealthier towns in order to compensate for the same loss in students.
So, but here's the question, Dan, and I'm sure you can anticipate this. If, you know, two kids leave Concord schools and grab this, then, yeah, you have the same number of teachers and janitors, and you still got to turn the heat and the lights on. But if 30 kids from Concord schools choose this, eventually you can hire less staff. So you're saving money at the public school. So it's not a, you know, a quid pro quo or, an automatic equal sign.
So it's really hard to achieve cost savings because of how New Hampshire funds education. And so to your exact point, the average class size in New Hampshire for middle school is 20 students. So 20 students for every teacher. So let's take your scenario where under, and this is the optimum scenario for cost savings, 20 students in a middle school take a voucher. That school is going to lose 20 students worth of state aid, which is about $80,000. The average teacher salary is $58,000. So no matter what, that local community is now on the hook for $22,000. So there's no cost savings even in that optimum scenario. Imagine if 10 students leave, that school loses $40,000 and now either has to increase class size or cut a teacher.
And Kay, here's the question for you. Is it fair to ask taxpayers to help fund private education and maintain that local public system? Is that too much of a burden for taxpayers?
I mean, to me, I just see it as a different way of looking at public education, right? Because it's the same kind of way that I support my neighbor's children, right? I pay my property taxes in Manchester and support my neighbor's children's education, whatever, you know, education they might choose. And so I see it rather as an expansion of public education. It was interesting. I was talking to my daughter who was home last night, and she thought it was really interesting when I told her that that Dan supported public education and that he wasn't for this. She was surprised. She thought, oh, I would think that an organization that supports public education would be for this because it's almost an expansion of public education. So
expansion of public education?
Because it's state dollars, right? It's funding those children. And so in essence, it's still a continuation of public education.
So public dollars supporting whatever education
the child school building
needs.
Right. It might not be in a particular school building, but it's another way of providing public education for children. And I know that's kind of an out-of-the-box way of looking at it. But in essence, you know, my experience with families is such, Laura, that, you know, for example, in my own family, you know, as a mom, you know, I have three daughters, and two of them do very well in their traditional school setting. And one was my muse kind of for doing this work, where she just didn't fit. It just wasn't a good fit for her. You know, one out of three, really, she needed something totally different. And I struggled for so many years to find the right fit for her. But, you know, something like this in place would have made it so that I could have better met her needs, you know, whereas my other two are totally content and happy with their straight A's and their, you know, blonde ponytails. But the other thing, you know, while I appreciate Dan's perspective on and what he's sharing, you know, for me as a taxpayer, I know that my taxes go to Manchester, whether my children attend those schools or not. And so they do keep that money. This is a really small portion of you know, state funding, but it means so much to the families that it would help, that to me it makes good sense. You know, for example, you were mentioning also the savings and that's a whole, you know, thing we can dig into to for hours. And I don't know if it really, you know, impacts, you know, people on their opinions of whether or not they think this is a good idea. But, you know, like say 5% of the students take an ESA, you know, like
education,
like
savings Dan's, account.
You know,
yeah.
Kind of doomsday, you know, thought. You know, that means that a school district, you know, keeps basically, that's only 5% of their students. They still have 95% of the aid, you know, the state aid that they would otherwise receive, and 100% of their local dollars, because those stay right there. So if you know, add those together, it's about 98% still of the dollars that they still have.
So we'll have untangle that a little bit more after a short break. Yeah. So, and calls are starting to come in, so that's great too. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Got some emails in front of me as well, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a revised school choice bill is before the House Education Committee tomorrow. It would set up what are called education savings accounts for families. We're finding out how these work, how they're funded. That's one of the big issues. Let's get your questions into The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Dan Vallone is here, Director of Engagement for Reaching Higher NH, along with Kate Baker, head of the Children's Scholarship Fund, and Jason Moon, Education and Seacoast reporter for us here at NHPR. And Jason, before we go to our listeners, I'd love your thoughts on that very interesting intellectual debate we had between Kate and Dan just before the break. You know, the idea that public dollars go towards these education savings accounts, families can access them to use them for whatever they want, homeschooling, private education, and so forth. And it's kind of a rethink, isn't it? You know, some people would say, wow, public dollars should go to public schools, meaning that building in that place. Kate presented an alternative view, which is public dollars should go to support that family, educate their child. That's what the public is paying for, education, not necessarily a spot on a map.
Yeah, and that, it really gets at the core of the sort of philosophical debate about this issue, which is not just happening here, it's happening in so many states across the country. It's happening at the Federal Department of Education right now. And, you know, these aren't necessarily new ideas, but they're sort of coming into their own right now. They're really kind of having a heyday. I mean, the basic idea is about introducing some market principles into education and to force schools to compete, to get better. You know, one of the ideas is that if public schools are now threatened to lose students, that they'll up their game, that they'll get better.
More innovative,
right?
More creative.
So that's one of the arguments that are posed in favor of these. But you're right, it is a kind of reimagining in some way of what education means, whether the public school system is just simply outdated and whether you can do it better at home or at a private school, or, you know, should everyone just be able to choose for themselves? And the rub of it is how granting individuals those freedoms affects a larger public system. And that's where the rubber hits the road.
Let's hear from our listeners. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Mike is in Portsmouth. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you. I'd like to point to Plessy versus Ferguson. Separate but equal. That's what the idea being proposed essentially is. By separating everything and saying, oh, it's our choice, it's really disingenuous. Taking away from the whole hurts everybody. That's my comment. Talk to you later.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Mike. And, you know, this has come up, Kate. You know, you take away from the whole and it hurts everybody. Go ahead. I'd love your thoughts.
Well, you know, my thoughts kind of, if we're going to go back in time, you know, our zip code system really is creating pockets of socioeconomic, you know, highs and socioeconomic lows. And so for me, I see a system like this as with more fairness, right? When you're a low-income family, now you have mobility where you might choose a school in a more affluent neighborhood, right? Or you might choose a private school that you otherwise would never not have access to versus our current zip code system, which really is kind of socioeconomic discrimination. You know, I know that, you know, kids that attend Bedford High School, and I mean, that's not kind of a diverse melting pot really at all, and nothing against them, right? They've created that for their own town, for themselves. But I see a system like this as being more equitable.
What do you think, Dan?
So public education is a public good, which means that everyone has an equal right to access it. And this has been a struggle in public education, as the caller mentioned. I mean, it wasn't until Brown versus the Board of Education that we started to realize that we put into law that you can't discriminate on the basis of race. And education law has been a series of efforts to try and remove impediments that denied students access to education on the basis of race, on the basis of learning disability. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act was passed in 1965. It's a civil rights law. It was passed alongside of the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. The Individuals with Disability Education Act was passed in 1975. But all of those laws are trying to help create a system in which no student can be discriminated against on the basis of innate characteristics and their aptitude. And the issue when we look at voucher bills is that they provide public dollars, which should go to public good, to private entities that have selective admissions criteria. So private schools are a fundamentally different system. They can deny admissions to students on the basis of prior academic achievement, on the basis of learning disability, if it's a severe learning disability, on kind of whatever metrics they want to impose as their admissions criteria. So when you start putting public dollars towards those private entities, you create a segregated system while depriving public schools of the resources that they use to serve all of our students.
What about Kate's point, though? And we'll pick up on that other point you made, Dan, in a minute. But what about her broader point that, you know, in a way, you could look at this as opening up access to that child who lives in a poor neighborhood where the schools aren't that great. I mean, we all know that, you know, not all public schools are created equal. So
this is why I think it's helpful to have those three criteria, because we need to we too often box ourselves in as if vouchers are the only option to create personalized learning or even choice. I worked in the Federal Charter School Program, which is the largest investor in charter schools in the country. And so charter schools are one option to create choice, but they're public. So they have to admit and serve all students. They cannot deny admissions to students. Second, in New Hampshire, we have to think about what works for our state's unique context. We have a lot of small schools. So the way we can achieve choice and personalization here in New Hampshire, which is what I think we're actually trying to do, is through things such as extended learning opportunities, which enable students to earn credit anywhere. We have this great example of a student, I think, in Hinsdale, who, again, had some troubles with anxiety in the classroom. So the student took an ELO with an equestrian academy in the local community, earned credit, and thrived. And there's all kinds of stories like that where in New Hampshire, using a community-based school approach, we create personalized learning pathways that work for each student and don't deny anybody the opportunity.
Well, here's an email from Don who says, this should be about the best possible education for our children, not how many teachers the public school system employs. So what about that, Dan? And Don, thank you for the email. You know, he seems to be saying what Kate was saying. Think outside the box. Think a little bit more broadly than just, you know, that school on Street A and that school on Street B.
So when we did our analyses, we really tried to think about what would be the potential impact on all the students. And that's why we focused on looking at local tax rates, for example, because we all know that there are schools across our state who are right now facing declining enrollment. The New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies produced a very comprehensive report looking at the really stark outcomes that rural New Hampshire could be facing as we transition as a state, demographically speaking.
Yeah, then people are having fewer kids, the state is aging. So just naturally, the number of school-age kids is going
down. So we really
down.
Need to be thinking about what works for New Hampshire's unique context. And when a program that would require Berlin to raise taxes by 37 cents versus Moulton Borough raising taxes by 2% to compensate just for 3% of students taking a voucher, that is not what seems to be best for our state. And just one quick note on the 3%, 5%, what we used to pick our 1% to 5% model,
how many students might take advantage of this.
In April, the Commissioner of Education, Frank Edelblue, went on Gerard at Large radio show and said 2% was the take-up rate, looking at examples in Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. And then in communications in this month, we've seen from proponents of this bill, 3% is actually what they say as the reasonable take-up rate. So we actually tried to model very conservatively what people who are proponents of this bill and what policymakers say are reasonable take-up rates.
Well, Don, thank you for the email. Here's a Facebook comment from Scott who says, why do the funds have to come from public schools? The money should come from new revenues. Scott says if Republicans think about choice, if they think choice is so important, they should raise taxes to fund their efforts. So what about that, Kate? The problem that some people have with this approach is that the money is coming from public dollars and they worry that it's coming, might go to a private institution.
Right. So, you know, my thought is, and again, I guess I look at this differently, but the children don't disappear, right? I mean, they're still like Manchester kids, like my, you know, children are still Manchester children, no matter what education opportunity they might be choosing. And so to see them as revenue loss, right? Like Dan is describing, there are many, many people that will describe that, Laura, as a cost savings, right? So the average per pupil cost is $14,000-$15,000 per child. And if through public education, through these public dollars or this general fund new line item, we're funding those children at maybe $3,000 or $5,000, I mean, there's $10,000 there somewhere in between. And, you know, I know that we can talk about fixed versus variable costs, which is what Dan will tell you is where the revenue driver is. But to me, I just take the numbers and, you know, add or subtract them, and they seem pretty basic to me. So, and the children don't disappear, right? So if he's talking about lost teachers' jobs, I mean, they're still going to be, the children are still in New Hampshire, and so we need the same amount of teachers for the same amount of children in New Hampshire.
Go ahead, Dan, real quick, and then let's go back to our listeners.
Sure. So, and I know that a lot of numbers being thrown out there for your listeners, so I appreciate it for all being very patient. So that $15,000 is very misleading. That's not the cost to educate a child. If five new students show up to a school in the second week of school, that school doesn't need to raise $75,000. We know that's not true. And I would think about it, and I would encourage your listeners to think about it this way. You know, if there's a couple with one child and they have a monthly mortgage of $1,500, when that child grows up and, you know, that's a per person cost of $500. When that child grows up and leaves, their mortgage doesn't go down to $1,000, right? It's still $1,500. So all of the educational infrastructure that communities invest in, they still have to pay for, kind of irrespective of whether there's small changes in the numbers of students. What SB 193 proposes is you could introduce significant volatility in student enrollment, which would then impact local taxpayers who would have to take up the downshifting of costs that the removal of state aid causes.
Do you want to jump in, Jason? A lot of numbers, and it's hard to figure out, but not that you're not giving it your best effort, because you are. And I think I understand where you're coming from, that, you know, again, if three kids leave, it's one thing. If 30 kids leave, it's another thing. But go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I just think one of the big questions about this is the take-up rate. That'll be one. If this becomes law, that will be one of the big things to watch.
How many people say, yes, I would like this education savings account?
And not just overall, but in particular communities. You know, if it anecdotally, if say there's a, you know, say there's a problem with a particular teacher in a public school, and maybe a dozen kids or 15 kids from that public school decide, you know what, we've had it with this guy, we're out of here. They would have that option now, which is in essence what you want with the bill if you're a supporter of it. But those are the kinds of troubling scenarios that people will put on the other side of it, that could really cripple a school district.
Well, the other thing, I'm thinking about the unique nature of New Hampshire and, you know, in Nashua, Manchester, Concord, if you were dissatisfied with your child's school, you know, you might have some other options close by. If you're in a small town, you know, in western New Hampshire or up north, you probably aren't able to access choice as much.
That's another a big debate about these types of programs everywhere, which is who's going to be actually able to access these. That's the reason a lot of these programs are targeted at disadvantaged students, because one of the concerns is that, as many of us know, you know, $3,300 per child isn't enough to pay for tuition at a lot of private schools. That's many private schools, that's a drop in the bucket.
Other private schools, a lot of the Catholic schools, I looked at this yesterday, right, and at least one's in the Concord area, and one was about $6,000, one was about $11,000. So in those cases, the $3,000 would help.
It can make a difference, but the concern that many who oppose these types of programs would raise is that this is just going to help affluent kids go to private school with public dollars that they don't really need.
Yeah.
And so that's a concern that's raised often.
That comes up because, Jason, you told us earlier, in other states, it's more targeted towards low income. Right. The argument has been this will help, you know, middle class families go, all right, we couldn't afford Derryfield before, but now maybe we can with this little extra help.
In a perfect scenario, these programs are an escape valve for kids who are, quote unquote, trapped in failing public schools. You know, that's really at the heart of this idea, is that it would give parents and students an option if they feel like they're out of them at their public school.
Kate, what about that? The idea that, you know, stick with the low income criteria, that this would help middle class and even rich kids afford a private education.
I mean, the thought process for me is, in essence, the wealthy already have this, right? Because they already have access. And so, for example, we have income limits on our scholarship program of 300% of the poverty line or below.
That.
but yet 77% of our scholarship recipients are in fact free and reduced lunch children. So much lower income is the families that we're hearing from. And so it, to me, it is somewhat self-selecting in that someone's going to take the time to go through all this rigmarole to get their education savings account is very highly likely to be someone who really needs it.
But
you know?
Should this funding, public funding, be available to a family that could afford it on their own, but then they say, hey, sure, why not? Let's take this $3,300.
I mean, I probably would support it either way, Laura, because...
Because of that philosophy that you presented.
Yes, for me, it is, you know, the dollars that we're talking about are the tax money that we're paying. And so I do have a lot of families who are disenchanted if they're like $1,000 over the income limits, right? They might call us and say, you know, I want to send my special needs child to a Montessori school because they have autism, but... You know, I earn, you know, $74,000 and I have a family of four instead of $73,000 and I have a family of four. And I can't afford the tuition that's $7,500, which would be, right, $750 a month or so in tuition. If they're a family of four earning $70,000, that's a big stretch, right? And so I might say to you that, yes, that family, even though they're $1 over the income limits for the scholarship program, should be able to access some assistance to be able to get what they need for their child.
I think the philosophical point, though, that Jason was raising is, should somebody who is perfectly wealthy also be able to access an extra $3,300 of public money when they don't need it?
I mean, they pay taxes also.
Well, that's your broader point,
right? Yes,
that this is public dollars to educate students, so let people decide where to spend it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, don't judge whether they should or should not. Go ahead, Dan.
But just to be clear, though, this would create segregated systems that you could imagine a scenario where Manchester tax dollars flow out of Manchester to private schools in much wealthier neighborhoods.
It's just the state dollars. It's not the local
dollars. State adequacy is funded in part by what's called the statewide education property tax, SWEPT, which consists only of local tax dollars. So this is a very, again, that's a lot of technical terms being thrown out there. But when we think about what is the problem we're trying to solve, create options for students, look at the research. Look at what New Hampshire's unique context speaks to and try and avoid policies that have been demonstrated to produce negative outcomes for students. SB 193 does not satisfy those criteria by any objective measure. And there are alternatives that we can and should be talking about how to create meaningful choice that is accessible by every single student in New Hampshire and does not disadvantage our property poor communities or our cities such as Manchester.
Here's an email from Lisa who says, I really wish this option had been available a few years ago. I homeschooled my five kids, but simply could not afford to continue as they got older. Lisa says, I couldn't get the kits for science or the classes for music and art. This new proposal would have enabled us to continue. So Lisa, thank you for that. I have a couple emails about people expressing concern about kids with special needs. Here's one from Eileen, who says, as a special needs educator of 30 plus years, I am deeply concerned about genuine rights and services for special needs students and the constitutional issue of separation of church and state. I have a couple other emails, too, about special needs kids. Janice in Dover says, will these schools be required to provide special education? Don't many currently require waivers for those needed services? So maybe after a break, I'll ask you all about that, because I've got a number of emails from folks concerned that this would not adequately protect students with special needs. So we'll pick that up after a short break, and we'll keep taking your calls. So stay on the line. The number 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, round two for a school choice bill known as SB 193, setting up what are called education savings accounts for families to use for alternatives to public schools. The exchange number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, Jason Moon, I think to you first. Just before the break, I read a couple emails from listeners who were concerned that this would leave kids with special needs behind, that, you know, they might access the education savings account, go to the private school, and the private school would say, you don't fit in here, and sorry. So that this is kind of inherently unfair for those children. That's the complaint that we got from our emailers.
Yeah, that email you read right before the break really raised what will likely be, if this bill is passed, what will be the two main legal challenges to it. One is about the separation of church and state, whether these private where this public money would be going to private parochial schools. And the other is this special education issue, where kids in public schools have lots of legal protections for, you know, special disabilities or learning needs. And the concern is that under a program like this, it's not clear that they would get those in those private institutions. So you could have a situation where you have public money funding the education of a student that doesn't receive the protections he would in a public school. So is that legal? You know, that'll be something that will likely be argued in New Hampshire courts if this is passed.
Yeah, and I have a couple emails, too, on the religion argument in a moment. But, Dan, you talked earlier about your background with applying civil rights laws in a public education context. So I'd love your thoughts here, too, and KU as well.
Sure, and this is one of the most significant concerns, because when we look at that third criteria I mentioned at the outset, which was, what is the probability this is going to negatively impact students? Voucher programs have demonstrated in other states to be detrimental to the best interests of students with disabilities, with learning disabilities. And this is a very significant concern in New Hampshire. We can talk about how this is just a fundamental civil right, that every student should have equal access to the same opportunities, and that any system that creates differentiated options is antithetical to that notion. But even just, and again, going into some numbers, New Hampshire, according to the State Department of Education, about 16% of kids in the public schools received special education services in 2016. They do an annual census, and it's been 16%, 15% is about the number that if you look across various sources we have. Those are students who have received special education services. SB 193 would provide public dollars to go to private entities which are not required to serve those students. And the way it works, broadly speaking, in the public school system, under the Individuals with Disability Education Act, a student with an IEP the school has a commitment to that student to service that IEP.
And it says, by law, school has to do that.
If that IEP is violated, the parents and the student can take the school to court. And the Supreme Court has weighed in, saying that that is a very high standard that we have to meet as communities and as a state and as a country to deliver on that promise for students. In the private school system, there is no right to all of your services in an IEP. It's a fundamentally different system that does not give, for example, an appeals process. In the public school system, if a student with a disability is up for suspension and expulsion, there is a very comprehensive appeals process to ensure that this is not a manifestation of that student's learning disability. In the private school, there's no such provision. So this is a serious consideration in New Hampshire, where, again, 16% of our kids in school, this applies to them.
Kate, go ahead, because we've got a number of emails about this.
Sure. For the families that I'm hearing from that have IEPs, that want to make a different choice, that want to choose a private school or choose homeschooling, in many cases, that process that Dan is describing is not working for them, right? For example, I have a mom right now who has a scholarship from us who is in negotiations with her district about a manifest education hardship, and they've been going through that process for like two years, her trying to get an out-of-district placement and not finding any results or any relief. And so she comes to us and gets a scholarship and is able to at least have her child in a safe environment where she knows that he's not in danger, right? And so if a family is choosing to utilize this scholarship tool or an education savings account tool to make a different choice for their child, you know, for example, again, you know, that family that I keep thinking of, it's a grandmother that has custody of her grandchild who has autism, and she chooses to send him to the Montessori school. It was because the IEP process wasn't working for her, and she wasn't getting, the child wasn't getting what they needed. And in this education environment, they are. And so it's not that it's you know, the way Dan is describing it is talking about all children, right? And I would just point back to what Jason said, where this is an escape, you know, kind of escape route for some kids, and to discuss it in terms, you know, someone can always go back to their, like my coworker Kathy, who does, you know, send her special needs child to public school. That's her choice. That will always exist for someone. This is an alternative.
Let's take another call. And this is April in Pembroke. Hi, April. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I am calling in as a New Hampshire resident, and I'm also a mom of five to a special needs with autism diagnoses. And I think it's important that we do live in the live free or die state. And I think what's really great about the bill is that it's returning choice to parents. It's allowing parents the control to make the best choice for their child instead of limiting their children to the only, what may be the only alternative for them, which is their local school.
So, April, we were just talking about kids with special needs, and you said that you have two. We got a couple emails, April, from listeners who said, hey, you know, private schools don't have to do right by these students the way public schools do on paper. And Kate's explained how it doesn't always work out in practice. What do you think about that as a mom with two kids with special needs?
Well, being very aware of the IEP process, I know that just as one of the panelists was talking about, placement can be outside of your public school. And when that happens, you still retain your IEP rights. So you can still retain those, but I know I've certainly been frustrated to the point that I wanted to remove my child from the public school system because when your child is not getting the services that your child needs to advance, and it's a fight to fight for them, and it's exhausting. Your goal as a parent is to do what's best for your child, and it's not always your local school.
Well,
and that's been my experience. And so I have chosen Mill Falls Charter School, which is the first Montessori charter school in our state, and it's been a wonderful experience.
Okay. April, thank you so much for calling in, especially since we were just talking about parents with kids who have special needs and where they might go. And actually, I want you to let you know, April, that Kate said, call me as head of the Children's Scholarship Fund. But she also mentioned charter schools. Now, that's an option, Dan, that you said you support.
And I've done a lot of work with charter schools at the federal level and then here in New Hampshire on the advisory board for a charter school in Manchester. It's a public school, and that means it has to serve all students. And that's a fundamental kind of basic principle that we should always apply when we talk about public education. And I appreciate April calling in, and that's a very powerful story. And what it makes me think of is the fact that we need to be cognizant of the fact that we're looking at 180,000 students in New Hampshire, and we have to make sure that we apply those three criteria: research, New Hampshire's local context, and the probability this is going to negatively impact kids very strictly when we think about this. And here's what I look at the data. So again, 16% of the students in New Hampshire receive special education services. Ms. Baker's scholarship program, I believe in the previous episode, mentioned about 11% of your students have IEPs.
That's right.
So that means the scholarship program is underserving students with who have learning disabilities. And that's not an indictment against the scholarship program. It is simply a reflection of the fact that public schools and private schools are fundamentally different systems built and designed to do different things.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And public schools are built and enshrined in law the right to serve every single student. And the extent to, you know, public schools, and I appreciate what April mentioned about the struggle that parents too often encounter. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about how are we going to help deliver on our state's promise to every single student. There are ways we can improve our special education laws and provisions to make the process easier without forcing them into a segregated system that gives some parents choices while denying choices to others.
It really is the opposite of segregated, though. We already established that, right? The current zip code system, when you're assigned to a school by your zip code, I mean, that is segregating. You know, this is giving people mobility to be able to move from those areas where they're assigned by zip code. And so that's frustrating that Dan keeps painting it that way when, in fact, it does have the exact opposite effect.
The concern I have and that we need to raise is the law does not require private schools to admit and serve all students. In fact, SB 193 does not require private schools who would receive public dollars to admit and serve all students. In fact, SB 193 includes in it a provision that says parents would be waiving their rights under the Individuals with Disability Education Act, an explicit forfeit of fundamental civil rights. So that's why this is a segregated system, is that it would give some parents options and it would give other parents no options, and while taking resources from those parents and those students who are in the public schools.
What it actually says is that it's the same as if a family was to make that choice right now. Okay, so for example, if a family with a special needs child chooses currently to send their child to a private school, and we hear from families a lot, right, my child was dyslexic and needed different services. I mean, people are talking about this all over. Rather, it says that it's the same as doing that, which is currently federal law already. It's not exempting from that.
It's called parental placement, and it is a way you waive the rights under the IDEA.
Here's an email that gets to this idea of, are we promoting segregation or not? This is Laura in Keene, who says, unless the education savings account is going to fund the full cost of that student's attendance at a private school, and unless legislation is going to require private schools to accept all children, regardless of special needs, race, gender, socioeconomic status, then what we are really doing is just giving a hand up to people who don't need it. Laura says, let's be honest. This is about making sure that affluent white parents or upper middle class white parents don't have to send their kids to school with brown children and poor children. Laura says, public schools are part of the social contract. We start dismantling them. We start dismantling our democracy. Laura, thank you for the email. There's a lot here, Kate, and I can see you want to jump in.
That's actually not what we see, yeah. Laura. So we actually have a much higher percentage of minority population that choose these programs than the general population of New Hampshire. You know, for example, in New Hampshire, it's like 90-10, and we're seeing more like 75% white in our program, and you know the other percent is increasingly diverse. In addition, I'm also hearing from families who are calling me and talking about discrimination as the reason why they want to choose a different school. And so I find that email somewhat frustrating.
I think one of the issues that Laura raises is, you know, she says, unless the ESA is going to fund the full cost of a student's attendance at a private school, $3,600 is a drop in the bucket.
Well, a special needs child does get more under this, and a free and reduced lunch child does get more. And then we could offer additional scholarship funds for low-income families like we do now on top of it. And so rather than discuss how it wouldn't work, I mean, for me, I'm looking at it as, you know, how do we help low-income families to be sure it does work?
Well,
right?
And we talked earlier, too, and Jason, you mentioned this, right, that for some schools, like the Derryfield School, I think is either $32,000 or $34,000. So $3,000 doesn't help a lot.
We had a scholarship student who was receiving our scholarship that then got a full scholarship to Derryfield. So she didn't need us anymore,
sure,
because they...
Yeah. But for other, some of the local Catholic schools, again, you know, $3,000, $3,600 would help pay for half the cost and so forth. Boy, lots to go through. Laura, thank you so much for that email. And Amy is in Sugar Hill. Let's go to Amy. Hi, Amy, go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I have twins who are now 23. They're out of the school system. They went through the public schools. It was not easy. It took a lot of work and advocacy to get what they needed through the school system. But I find that this whole discussion is really much more, it really is a matter of segregation, and that when energy is taken out of the public schools, then that's less energy, that's less advocacy for the public schools, and I think that it shows kind of a cynical direction that that choice is really a guise for this segregation.
Well, Amy, yeah, and reiterating the point that Lauren Keene made in her email. So, Jason, we've moved away from sort of, you know, numbers on the page, per student cost, local districts, taxes, to this broader philosophical concern.
Yeah, and she really gets at to take the broader view of these, of this kind of school choice debate, this gets at one of the real nuggets of this debate, which is that public school proponents sometimes will argue that all these programs are meant to simply chip away at a public school system.
That's the point that Laura made in her email.
Right, that an ultimate goal here is privatization, and that the argument goes that these programs create a situation where you have public schools competing with private schools, but public schools have more, they have to follow more restrictions, and meanwhile they're getting less funding because of the law, and it sort of sets up a self-defeating cycle. At least that's how it's seen by people, by some people, by a lot of people in this country. On the other hand, we have these incredibly powerful individual stories where people who feel like the public system isn't working for me.
And they're paying tax dollars already for a system that they feel is not working for them. So they say, let's try something new. Let's do a rethink, like Kate said earlier. So here's an email from Carol in Greenland. She says, I work at a public school on the seacoast, and I fully understand both sides of this debate. Carol says, if public education didn't have to fight for every dollar, both sides could work together. She says, why do legislators who support vouchers seem to vote against more money for public education? Is that the middle ground on this, Kate? What do you think? That if public schools...
I think it's a really hard discussion.
It's all about the money,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, it is. It's such a hard discussion because student population is declining, but expenditures are increasing. And test scores are, you know, you just wrote about this, Jason. Test scores are declining. So it's really hard discussion, Laura, I think, just in general.
Do you think there'll be legal challenges, Kate, if this bill becomes law?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
We
also remember the scholarship program, the education tax credit was also challenged. And we spent 2 years going all the way to the Supreme Court discussing the constitutionality of it. And so I would expect to do the same thing again.
Okay. Jason and then Dan.
Yeah, it'll be many, as you said at the beginning of the show, it'll be many of the same arguments. The big difference here is that with the business tax credit, that was sort of money on the back end. So businesses were giving money to scholarship funds and then getting a write-off in their taxes. So money the state was giving up and not necessarily spending. In this case, it's the state money that's going directly to these.
So as our emailer Carol said, it's kind of all about the money. Go ahead, Dan.
So I just want to say that this has been a great conversation. And fundamentally, it is possible to both create personalized learning in the public school system that does not deny or discriminate opportunities for all students. And I would just kind of close by saying New Hampshire is the only state in the country that received a waiver to move away from standardized testing and apply project-based learning in its schools across the state. That's an example of New Hampshire local innovation driving reform that helps every single student and moves towards personalized learning that is available to all.
You're talking about competency-based?
This is competency-based education, learning. Project-based, very work-based learning.
Well, thank you for the promotion because we're going to be doing a show on that in a couple weeks. So if people want to know about competency-based education or chime in with their thoughts, we're open. We'd love to get an email or a Facebook comment from you on that. All of you, thank you very much. Lots more we could have talked about. Kate, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Kate Baker, head of the Children's Scholarship Fund. Dan Vallone, good to see you.
Great, good to see you. Thank you.
Dan Vallone, Director of Engagement for Reaching Higher NH. And Jason Moon, thank you for helping us out.
My pleasure.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.